In September 2021, the Art Institute of Chicago told its volunteer museum educators, known as docents, that they would no longer serve in a volunteer capacity. Had the docents been delivering subpar performances? No, they were overwhelmingly white. And that, in 2021, constituted a sin almost beyond redemption. The racialist wave that swept the United States following the arrest-related death of George Floyd has taken down scientists, artists, and journalists. Entire traditions, whether in the humanities, music, or scientific discovery, have been reduced to one fatal characteristic, whiteness. And now the anti-white crusade is targeting a key feature of American exceptionalism, the spirit of philanthropy and volunteerism. The Art Institute of Chicago is a case study in what happens when cultural organizations declare their mission to be anti-racism. The final result, if unchecked, will be the cancellation of a civilization. Museum directors have embraced the idea that museums are primarily a tool of exclusion, not inclusion. Art Institute leaders complain that the Institute's founders did not consider gender, ethnic, and racial equity. But no museum founder in the late 19th century was considering gender, ethnic, and racial equity beyond a generalized aim to make beauty widely available to a democratic citizenry. The artists' names carved across the exterior of the Art Institute's original building are an especially fertile source of self-flagellation. The 35 names are a who's who of Western art and architecture, starting with Praxiteles and Phidias from classical Greek times, proceeding through the early and high Renaissance, including Fra Angelico, Brunelleschi, Ghiberti, Da Vinci, Michelangelo, and Veronese, and into the Baroque, Rubens, Van Dyck, Velasquez, and Rembrandt. The roll call extends into the 18th century and ends with early 19th century Romanticism. No such list can be exhaustive, and one can always quibble with the choice. These 35 creators are nevertheless justifiably presented as paragons of human achievement. Yet if landmark preservation laws allowed, the Institute would have sandblasted its entablature away by now. The phrase is a, quote, unsustainable formulation, Director James Rondeau said in 2019. The museum's equity statement complains about the, quote, omission of artists of color, especially Black artists, as well as female, Indigenous, and non-Western artists. Only an intellectual adolescent would reduce such diverse artists as, say, Giotto, Durer, and Murillo, also members of the frieze, to the common denominator of whiteness and maleness. The absence of any historical awareness on the part of frieze critics is striking, especially coming from an art museum. There were no known indigenous artists that the Institute's founders should have memorialized. American Indian art was anonymous, produced within a collective craft tradition. As for Black and female artists, whom do the Institute's equity enforcers think that the 1893 frieze should have included? There were few pre-20th century Black artists and architects, and none possessed the influence of Botticelli, Wren, or Titian, also commemorated on the frieze. There were more female artists, and much effort has gone into elevating them to the creative pantheon. The Baroque painter Artemisia Gentileschi is a particular target for promotion. But however accomplished her work, only gender equity could justify inducting her into the highest ranks. It would be enough to lovingly preserve history's treasures and to teach visitors to understand those treasures' place in the evolution of human expression. A museum's comparative advantage lies in its art historical expertise, not in any supposed capacity for racial justice work. But cultural authority today comes from one of two sources: the assertion of victimhood or the acknowledgement that one is itself a victimizer. It is not open to the Institute as a collective body to take the first course, given the race and sex of its founders. That leaves the vigorous assertion of racial guilt as the second best means of retaining cultural capital. The docents were sacked to atone for that presumptive racial guilt. The Art Institute's chairman, Robert Levy, wrote in an op-ed that the docents constituted a, quote, barrier to engagement. The Institute was chosen to, quote, center our students across Chicago as we take this unexpected moment to rethink, redraw, and iterate. Centering Chicago students means not subjecting them to the trauma of learning about art from white females volunteering their time and energy. The overt white culling that doomed the docents is becoming frequent. In November 2021, the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento, California, bragged about its own, quote, progress in culling its docent corps, which was down from 85% white in 2017 to 76% white in 2019. Given the, quote, inarguable truth that museums are the legacy of Western colonialism, serving as the products of straight, able-bodied white male privilege, the museum explained, reducing the number of white docents was essential to ensuring that Crocker could serve as a, quote, safe space to talk about systemic inequality and inequity. The persistent denigration of our cultural institutions and their supporters as bearers of oppressive white privilege is taking its toll. During an equity and inclusion session for the board of the Whitney Museum of Art in October 2021, one wealthy donor observed that it was, quote, a tough time to be a non-for-profit leader. People are tiptoeing around every issue, afraid of every word coming out of their mouth being sliced and diced. It may be difficult to get the next generation of leaders, this donor added. There is no counterpart to American philanthropy, not even in other Western nations. Now the anti-racism crusade erodes that tradition by the day. Good luck finding volunteers and donors if they are told that their whiteness brands them as pariahs. Western civilization is not about whiteness. It is a universal legacy. But those who should be guardians of that civilization, by portraying it as antithetical to racial justice, by dint of demographic characteristics, are impoverishing the world and stunting the human imagination.
Do we need docents?
Of course there should be docents. It's a fantastic reservoir of unpaid expertise that museums have long counted on. The training program at the Art Institute, which began in 1961, was the equivalent of an MFA in art history. It was rigorous, disciplined. Students had to do homework and they have to do constant training. Volunteerism is one of the bedrocks of civil society, and the people who want to donate their time is something to be celebrated, not castigated.
Jay Green, currently at the Heritage Foundation, did a study on the educational benefits of art museum tours for students. And what he found through a randomized study is that students that visited an art museum learned more than they did in a classroom. And kids wanted to go back to museums with their friends and parents. How do you think about the role of the art museum in teaching art and culture?
Well, there's no substitute for being in the presence of great works. Art illustrations can never capture the immediacy of an artwork, the brushwork, the color, the scale, the light. Coming into a museum is an essential first step, but obviously our K through 12 system is absolutely a vacuum when it comes to solid training in Western civilization and the evolution of literary style, of the visual arts, of architecture. Going to art museums should be essential to any student's education, certainly by the time he's in college.
Do you understand the argument that white women should not be docents?
No, it is an unbelievably facile argument. It only works one way. Nobody objects to blacks teaching whites. Reverse it, and that's somehow oppressive. The early 20th century in this country managed to assimilate waves of immigrants from impoverished rural European cultures by largely female white teachers who established high standards, expected conformity to essential middle-class norms of behavior, and were colorblind. They made no exceptions. They didn't engage in the current excuse that expecting promptness or accuracy or cleanliness or respect for authority was just a white norm that was oppressive to people outside the traditional Anglo-American culture. That argument is a recipe for racial resentment. It gives students an excuse not to put in any effort to look at education through the absolute trivialities of race and gender, rather than plunging headlong into the mystery of the past, into the greatness of creation, and to lose their own petty, narrow selves in something far greater and more sublime than they could yet imagine.
Was there any evidence of discrimination in the selection of the docent volunteers?
Zero. Anybody who wanted to sign up and was willing to put in the hours that it took to be adequately versed in the history of art. Now, what has been proposed for the Art Institute is foregoing 100 highly trained volunteers who were willing to work for hours a week, inculcating students into how to see art. The alternative now is 6 part-time paid volunteers. They will no way be able to cover the amount of tours that the docents were giving. This racial line drawing that presumes that we are unable to speak across color lines is just extraordinarily destructive and will narrow our social and creative possibilities.
Does it matter at all that the docents were volunteers? You sometimes hear that unpaid internships are unfair because of the inherent inequity for those students that lack resources and need to find paid work. Do you think anything about the docent firing relates to the voluntary aspect of the position?
I get that idea of unpaid internships being a luxury that students with more affluent parents can afford. But the people serving as docents are not using their docentships as legs up into the employment world. It's a gift. That's all it is. I'm not convinced that there are people from the favored demographic groups who have been prevented from serving because of the volunteer nature of this. If there are, that doesn't require sacking the people who have trained out of an act of love, wanting to share their passion for art with as many people as possible. A moral matter or a matter of public policy, this should be denounced. The anti-white bias that we saw in the Art Institute is now the modus operandi in practically every mainstream institution, certainly in the academy, where white males are at the bottom of the heap in getting academic jobs. That includes in STEM, which has discarded meritocracy and an emphasis on scientific knowledge in favor of the trivialities of gonads and melanin.
In one of your recent articles this past month in the City Journal magazine, you mentioned that the art curators are adding text on the wall next to the artwork that is politically charged and not relevant to the art.
Well, yeah, it's hilarious. I wrote about the Metropolitan Museum of Art contrasting 2 simultaneous exhibits that are up right now and their attitude towards what art should be presenting in or not. They have a small show that is of the Dutch masters from the Baroque period. The most well-known names are Rembrandt, Hals, and Vermeer. And the wall text accompanying the Met's own holdings complain about the fact that these Dutch Baroque painters didn't spend enough time painting scenes of slavery and colonialism and the oppression of the Dutch Republic. And it even berates some of its gorgeous still lifes, these marvelous compositions of luminescent silverware, glassware, peeled lemons, oysters, extraordinarily creamy fabrics, faults them for also not portraying slavery and anti-colonialism. Well, this is particularly stupid because a still life, by definition, does not have human subjects. Its objects, still life that portrays slavery, is somewhat of a mystery. The Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, that has rewritten 80 of its wall labels from its Dutch masterpieces collection to complain about the lack of attention to slavery and colonialism. It has the audacity to attack the greatest masterpiece by Rembrandt and its greatest holding of the Night Watch, which shows the civil guard of Amsterdam and the Rijksmuseum complains that there's no blacks in the picture. Well, Amsterdam's black population was below 1% at that time.
Most people do not read the wall text. Does it matter if occasionally it is drivel?
I don't think a wall text is drivel. I read them. I think they can provide valuable historical context. They can lead the viewer to see how a composition works. It's a valid addition to an art museum that viewers can choose to read or not. A museum's role is not just to slap a bunch of paintings on a wall.
Given the current polarization, should we insist that museums' textual analysis avoid political topics and instead stick to the facts, the name of the artist in the work, what school of art, the name of the benefactor, and the year it was produced?
I want to congratulate for adding an aspect of wall text, which is the provenance, who the donor was and when. I find it very interesting in exhibits that are collected from different museums to read where they're actually housed. It's a fascinating map of our cultural world to know that this painting is in Fort Worth. The migration of these great works throughout the world. Would I ban the information in wall texts to include just the bare minimum of facts? No, I'd rather reform them. I would rather put pressure on museums to discard their virtue signaling facile role as proponents of racial justice. I would just put pressure on those institutions to discard this specious social justice agenda and get back to their
core competence. Let's turn to the choice of which artists to have major exhibits. There seems to be resistance to doing shows for dead white men. Today, the Phillips Gallery in D.C. is showing Picasso's Blue Period paintings. Should Picasso get a national tour, or has the time for dead white male artists passed?
A former trustee told me that the Whitney Museum of Art curators proposed a retrospective of a major American artist and was just told outright can't do it. Wrong race, wrong gender. That is what's going on
across the board now. In Chicago, there's a privately run, for-profit Van Gogh exhibit that uses large-scale moving images of his paintings in an event space. The exhibits are packed day and night, and the crowd is young and hip and much more crowded than your typical museum that is usually nearly empty. Even more surprising is the expressions on the audience's faces. They're riveted and seem to be really enjoying the show. Whatever happened for the imperative to put asses in the seats? Going back to my example of the Picasso Blue Period show, if museums will not exhibit this content, should for-profits produce these blockbusters? How about a market solution?
Well, that's a good question. I would say there is something to being in the presence of these works, and a video or a photographic reproduction simply cannot convey the immediacy of this canvas. That having been said, cameras can do things that the human eye cannot do as far as close-ups. That can also be illuminating. The for-profit world can provide a supplement, but there is nothing that is an adequate substitute for these collections that were donated by people who wanted to share the beauty of art.
I was 11 years old when King Tut came to Chicago. This was my first blockbuster show. And the blockbuster show has become a phenomenon. It is a major fundraising source for art museums. But if the art museums will not show blockbusters, somebody will.
That's a good question. These institutions are going to be torn because one thing driving this rapid race towards social justice, virtue signaling, it is undeniably true that foundation funders, Mellon Foundation, Ford Foundation, are absolutely explicit that they are only going to give money to the fine arts, whether it's to a museum or to a classical music organization, if that organization is changing its staff demographics based on race and is programming based on oppression themes. So the museums will want to please their foundation donors. Darren Walker, the head of the Ford Foundation, wrote an absolutely appalling op-ed in the New York Times in 2019, complaining that museum boards were white and male and privileged. Well, talk about biting the hand that feeds you. Those are the people that are paying hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, to keep these institutions running. Get rid of them and good luck keeping it going. Darren Walker is one of the most pernicious influences
in
the museum world.
If museums put the great dead white artist paintings in the basement, should we encourage that these artworks be lent or sold to other institutions so that the public can enjoy them elsewhere?
That's a good point. Absolutely. In my City Journal Art Institute of Chicago article, I quote James Rondeau from a speech in 2019. He recounts a conversation he had with Alice Walton, one of the heiresses of Walmart. She created the Crystal Bridges Museum in Bentonville, Arkansas, which is a pretty woke museum. She asked Rondeau, could she have access to some of the Art Institute's mothballed collections in the basement, because the Art Institute possesses more works that have been donated than it has wall space for, to send as a touring exhibit to rural America. And Rondeau had this unbelievably condescending response. Well, Alice, I'm not sure that rural America needs to see Toulouse-Lautrec. And this idea of, oh, you should eat your art because it's good for you, that doesn't really apply to rural America. But by the way, Alice, could you please fund our under-resourced Black and Hispanic museums in Chicago? And this was the only thing that Rondeau said in a lecture in Iowa in 2019 that was filled with contempt for the white board of the Art Institute, because the white board of the Art Institute was not sufficiently enthusiastic about Rondeau's social racial justice crusade. But Rondeau's explicit contempt for rural white America was the only thing that got Ken Griffin, one of the board members, exercised. And he took Rondeau to task for this. Otherwise, the board was utterly supine to hear itself denigrated as just a bunch of wealthy white males. So yes, it would be good to show their holdings in other venues.
The Art Institute of Chicago mentions in its diversity, equity, and inclusion discussion that the museum is on the site of land originally owned and lived on by various Indian tribes. I heard similar rhetoric at the Stratford Festival in Ontario, Canada, before a theater production. Could you please explain this virtue seeking related to land use and cultural institutions?
Well, Larry, you have been paying attention. You're absolutely right. These land acknowledgements are now ubiquitous. Even university lecturers are giving land acknowledgements. And it is happening across cultural institutions. And I bet you it will start happening in corporations as well. There's nothing bad in the academy that will not migrate into a corporation at a rapidly accelerating pace. The Art Institute had nothing to do with their disappearance from the area around Lake Michigan. Is the American extermination of the Indians deplorable? Yes. These arts institutions have nothing to do with it. The near hysterical, neurotic obsession of mainstream white individuals and white institutions, which is the Lady Macbethian washing of hands, the apology for real or imagined racial guilt that no other civilization is engaged in currently. Have we engaged in colonialism and slavery? Yes. Name me a civilization that hasn't. This fanatical self-denigration is a perversity, and it is going to cancel an entire civilization.
Currently on exhibit at Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum is a show on Indonesia's uprising against the Dutch colonizers that included various photographs, posters, and textiles. What do you think of politically charged exhibits?
I'm not against history. I'm not against cultural context. There's a demystifying impulse that sees art simply as a means of perpetuating power structure and does not want to think of it as something that the individual artist is creating, sometimes to achieve beauty, but sometimes, of course, with a political agenda. Of course, there has been nationalist art, art that is driven to excite people, to inflame patriotic passions or revolutionary passions. And that absolutely should be acknowledged. There's art that has also tried to waken people to injustice, whether it's Hogarth or Zola or Goya, and that should be recognized. But what should not be done is the deconstructive gesture of saying, reading what is not there. We look for the absences. We look for the silenced voices. That generally, I'm really generalizing here greatly, but that is often just an excuse to not look at what is in a work of art and
to
politicize it.
Do you see any signs for optimism?
The optimistic sign will come only if people that have been given the vast privilege of curating the world's great treasures find the courage to speak out against this insane adolescent know-nothing assault. If more people do so, we will win. But if people remain silent, it is all going down.